So the topic this evening, is Chukas Hagoyim, Chukas Ha'akum. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're first going to try to establish the parameters, and then we're going to try to get into the contemporary. Well, first, going to actually try to ask some basic, try to say what are the basic questions, discuss the parameters, and then discuss contemporary questions. So the Sefer Achinuch is probably the first source to start with. So that is found, hold on,
page 89.
Okay, so the Sefer Achinuch says in Sefer Achinuch says in Mitzvah Reish Samach Beis that the goal is to distance ourselves from their practices. Okay, I remember in school I was teaching my students the introduction to some basic halachic works. And I showed them a picture of the Rambam, and someone said, "Why is the Rambam dressed like that? Why is he wearing a turban?" So what they were really asking, they know it is that Chukas Ha'akum. If you're wearing a turban, is that considered like a pagan dress? So we have to understand. When I said in those days, I said it's sort of like you're wearing Americanized clothes, and I'm wearing Americanized clothes. So like how we dressed back then, that was like wearing a turban. So the question is, what practices that are similar, are quote pagan practices, are considered pagan practices that we should sort of distance ourselves. But that's what the Sefer Chinuch says. The goal is to distance from their practices of filba malbush, even in terms of dress potentially. And it's based on the pasuk in Vayikra in source 3, Perek Yud Ches pasuk Gimel. Right? It says uvechukosei lo tilechi. Don't follow their statutes. Don't follow the statutes of the pagans. And Rashi, based on the Sifra, Rashi in Source 3, based on the Sifra, he says, what's he adding here? Because the Torah already said, "Kamase eretz Mitzrayim asher yishavtem ba lo tasu." Kamase eretz Mitzrayim asher ani beveitzchem shama lo tasu. Don't engage in their practices, and it says, "Don't follow their laws." So what's considered their laws? So the way that Rashi, it's a Sifra, right? Rashi is a commentary, an 11th century commentary. The Sifra is a halachic medrash. So that means this is something that the rabbis from the times of Chazal, the rabbis who were authors in the Mishnah and the Gemara, so Rashi takes his comments from the Sifra, and he says that this includes things that are devarim hachakukim lahem. So how would you translate that? Or how do they translate that? Devarim hachakukim lahem. Social custom. So why is it called a chok? Why is it a law? In other words, why is it called the v'chukoseim? In other words, why is it not minhogeim lo tasu?
It's written down.
It's written down. Right. Okay. Maybe it's written down, and maybe it's just established. It becomes a norm, right? It becomes a norm, and this becomes like a practice, a cultural practice. And obviously, it had to do with idolatrous rituals. And so, one of the examples are going to theaters and stadiums, right? Tartios and atstadios. Now, in the pagan times, they went to practice idolatrous rituals. Some people say baseball's avodah zarah, but I don't know if that's accurate. So we have to see. We saw some sort. So we have to understand. And then we have Rabbi Meir who says these are darchei ha'emori. These are darchei ha'emori. These are Amorite practices that the rabbis established. So there was a basic question, and I think the source went a little bit out of order. There's a basic question, which is the following. Darchei Amori, in chapter 7 and 8 in Masechet Shabbos, the Mishnah's list, I think, the Mishnah is what Rabbi Huda Nasi collected. So around the same time, there were other compendia that were collected, and one of them was called the Tosefta. And in the 7th and 8th chapter, Masechet Shabbos, so there's a whole list of Amorite practices that had to do with idolatry. They weren't idolatrous per se, but they had to do with idolatry. So one basic question in this whole discussion is the following. And that is, are quote, Darchei Amori, these kind of pagan practices that we have to desist from, are those only the practices that the rabbis listed, or can you have new ones? In other words, on the one hand, right, we have these theaters and You know, we said you can't go into theaters and stadiums. So we would say, in those days, they were idolatrous, right? But nowadays, they're not idolatrous, so maybe it shouldn't apply now. Is the flip side true as well? In other words, is it only limited to those things that, let's say, the rabbi said, these practices are pagan practices 2,000 years ago. What if there are practices now that may be, that may relate to, foreign religious practices? So that was a debate. I don't know if you saw this, like it was a little bit out of order, but I think in sources like 18 and 19, they had this debate between the Uraim and the Bach. The Uraim, he was a student, I believe, of Rabbeinu Tam. He was a Tosafist, and he said that is citing the Hagos Maimonides, and he if we follow him, then there's no question about Thanksgiving. There's no question about, you know, the morning practices that they're going to speak about. There's no question about, you know, certain customs of mourning.
Not on the list.
Because they're on the list.
What's the significance of the Amorim?
So apparently this was something that
they were not the only idolaters, right?
Right, so apparently they called that Darchi Amor. Apparently that these were things that they were the most idolatrous. I guess they had a tradition that's what they did. Right, and the truth is, it's interesting because this was when the Bnei Israel went into Israel, so they were the Kenanim and the Amorim. So I guess maybe their practices were more, their rituals were more prominent. It's a good question. I don't know specifically why it's called Darchei Mori, but they were probably more prominent. They may have been the dominant pagans, at least from their ritual practices when they conquered Eretz Yisrael. So that's a question. We don't follow the Uraim. We follow the Bach, which is in Yordea Kufayin Chesif Beis. This is in source 19, where the Bach, and it seems also the Rambam probably holds like that too, that we generally hold that it's not limited to the pagan practices in the time of Chazal, time of our sages. Even if nowadays there are pagan practices, then we still have to ask that question. They could violate Chukas Akum. So then we have to ask, number one, are pagan practices forbidden now if they're not considered idolatrous, like stadiums and theaters? And the flip side, and also, what makes something pagan? Is it idolatrous? Is it nonsense? Is it, if it's associated with licentious behavior, is it something that was started by pagans? Right? Those are, if you read some of the sources, so those are some of the questions that we have to ask, right? What defines something as being, quote unquote, a pagan practice, where the Torah tells us that you have to distance yourself from their practices? Is it idolatrous, licentious? Simply, it started from pagans, or maybe it's a nonsense. So what, you know, how do you view that? Right, that's really the starting point of the question. And there are two basic Gemaras. So you had the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which was in source, because it's source 9. So this is Sanhedrin Daf Nun Beis Amud Beis, which is, I guess, a side question as well, which is, what if a pagan practice is written in the Torah? So, what was the case there? What was the pagan practice that was written in the Torah?
How to give
capital punishment, but through scythe, through the sword. So there was a feeling that this was a pagan practice. However, since the Torah writes it, so that's not considered, it's not a violation of Chukas Akum, it's not a violation of a pagan practice. And if you're able to understand, it's a little complicated, sources 10, 11, and 12. Right, that was it's a few weeks ago already, and it was a little complicated. So there, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah suggested the Gemara in Avodah Zarah Daf Ches brings a debate between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim as to whether a festival when a king dies, is that like an idolatrous affair when the king dies. And there's a suggestion that, according to the Chachabib, that when they burn things, I don't know, to honor the king when he dies, that is a pagan practice. Okay? So, however, the question is, it's not so clear from the source here, but in Sefer Yirmiyahu, when Sitkiyahu, he was the last king from the Malchei Yehuda, He was the last king. And apparently in Sefer Yirmiyahu, it says that when he died, they actually burnt stuff when he died. So that practice is quoted in the Navi. So this is the question that Tosfos is dealing with. In the Gemara and Sanhedrin, it seems that if something's quoted in the Torah, it's not a violation of Chukas Akum as a pagan practice. However, in our Gemara and Avodah Zarah, they don't suggest, well, burning something is not a violation of Chukas Akum because it was written in Tanakh. They don't seem to give that as a solution. In other words, it seems that in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, if it's written in the Torah, it's automatically not a pagan practice. And then in Avodah Zarah, it doesn't seem like that. And the way that Tosfos resolves that is that Tosfos says it depends. If it's mentioned in the Torah and the practice is not idolatrous, so then it's permitted. So let's say executing someone with the sword, so that is, that's not idolatrous per se. So since it's mentioned in the Torah, it's not a violation of Chukas Akum. However, if it's mentioned in the Torah, but the actual practice itself is idolatrous, the thinking in the Gemara was that when you burn stuff, when the king dies, that actual practice is idolatrous. Understand? There's a difference if what you're doing is simply something that the pagans do, but itself is not idolatrous. In other words, killing someone with the sword, so the pagans do that, but that practice of killing someone with the sword, that's not idolatrous. So if it's written in the Torah, it's permitted. However, burning things for the king, maybe that is something that in and of itself is idolatrous. So even though it's recorded in Tanakh that they did it some for Jewish kings, but if the pagans do it, and if it currently is perceived as idolatrous, then you can't do it. That's really a side point, but that's just an important, you read the sources, that's like a side point in terms of it's written in Tanakh. The real crux of the question, if you want to know if contemporary issues that we're going to discuss is Chukas Akum, it's a debate between the Maharik and the Vilna Gaon. That is the key debate to all of our questions. And if you get that, then you get the whole shir. And if you understand that, so I want to make sure. If I'm not clear, then please ask me to repeat myself. Okay? The Maharik, some say it's the Maharik. He was a rabbi who lived, I think, in the 1400s, and he's quoted by the Ramah. It's Rav Yosef Kolod. This is Maharik in Simon Peches, in his Chuvos. This is, I think, in source 13. Okay? Yeah, sorry. Okay, source 13. So the Maharik says, if it's idolatrous, it's a pagan practice. If it's licentious, preetzus, it's a pagan practice. If the reason is completely unknown, so there's a concern that there might also be based on something idolatrous, if you don't know the reason. However, if there's a good reason for the pagan practice, what's the example he gives?
The white coat.
Thank God, because my daughter had a white coat. I was going to jump a ceremony and say, no white coats. So the white coat ceremony, which is even from the 1400s, the white coat ceremony would be permitted even though the pagans do it because there is a logical reason for it. There's a good reason that's not associated with idolatry. It's not associated with immoral behavior. There's a good reason for it. So if you have something that there's a good reason, nothing to do with idolatry, nothing to do with licentiousness, then even if it comes from the pagans, okay, that the pagans started this custom, so this would not be a violation of B'kukoseim lo telechu. This is the Rabbah. And again, this is probably based on the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, where we said that if you burn the possessions, the Gemara concludes, not Gemara in Avodah Zarah, that if you burn the possessions of the king, right? The Gemara ends up saying that if you burn the possessions of the king when he dies out of a sign of honor to the king, then that is not a violation of B'chukoseim lo telechu, that's not Chukas Akum. So you have to ask yourself, is there a good reason? If there's no reason, then we suspect maybe there's something licentious or something idolatrous, so we're a little concerned about that. That's how the Ramos says in Yoredea Kufay Ches Seif Aleph. That's what he writes, we'll just read it inside. In source 14, V'choze Eido Aser Ele B'davar Shedagu Bo Ovdi Kuchav L'Shum Pritzus. That Chukas Akum is only where the pagans did this for a licentious behavior. They're wearing red clothing. Okay, we're sorry, okay. But again, that depends back then that red was I think in certain communities they don't let some people wear red. But again, so that depends on what's perceived as licentious clothing, right? Okay, so it's societal to some extent. So that he said this is v'hu malbush, you know, sarim v'chadov lezemi malbushi apritzus. So this in those days it was a dress of licentiousness. Let's say they have some kind of custom. There's no real reason. Maybe there's something. There's some element of idol worship. But something that they did for a purpose. The white coat for the doctor. You're allowed to wear it. And also, if they do it for a kavod or another reason, it's permitted, right? So, okay. So that is the Rabbah's reason. The Vilna Gaon is more strict. The Vilna Gaon, this is source 16. The Vilna Gaon in Yeridei Kufayim Ches Iv Zayin, he says Ela Devade Hakol Aser. Everything's Aser. Rak Dafka Lilbod Behem Aser. Right, we don't learn from the Gentiles. So the Vilna Gaon says that anything that we would have come up on our own, then it's permitted. He's saying that even if there's a reason for it, if we could have come up with this idea on our own, that is permitted. But if this is something that came from the pagans, it's a violation of b'chulosem lo tilechu, even if it's a legitimate reason. Okay.
How does he get that from? How do you decide if this is something you would have gotten to on your own? Meaning, 90% of everything we do is like
imitation.
Based on not even imitation, but it's based on discoveries like. Scientific discoveries that were not Jewish discoveries.
Let's hold that question, okay. Because we're going to see that within some of the contemporary issues that we're going to discuss, we're going to see, for example, we talk about standing up for the siren for Yom HaZikaron. Okay. So there's one opinion that says we hold like the Ramah, so it's permitted. And there was another opinion that's going to say that we would have come up with that on our own. So let's save that. Let's try to flesh that out.
Okay.
Okay. Well, sorry.
That's super vague.
It's a little bit vague, right? In other words, is it something? So let's try to flesh. No, I hear what you're saying. No. Let's try to flesh out some of the examples, and then we'll see how this principle is applied, and then we could try to understand how they understand this principle.
I was thinking even more simplistic than the specific thing, like even like a genre of music.
Right.
It's considered a bizarre because we can come up with it.
A genre of...
I think well, there are people who don't listen to non-Jewish music.
No, but I don't think for that. So let's go through some of these rulings and we'll see how broad the Vilna Gaon and how narrow this is. I think for the most part, people generally hold like the Rabbah. The question is, the other reason, you know, there are two interesting perspectives of why we hold like the Rabbah. So one is, like I said, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, which says that burning the possessions of the king in his death is a sign of honor, not idolatry. It's not something that's idolatrous. So you got it from that Gemara in Avodah Zarah. So it seems like we pass in like that Gemara. The Stipler in the Kilos Yaakov says there's a deeper reason, because the whole reason is we might follow their ways. There's the whole reason of Chukas Akob is if we follow this, then we're going to follow their ways. However, if we've copied them, once we copy them in one area, then we're going to copy them in other areas. However, if the custom has a logic or it's explicit in the Torah, if there's a logic to it, then there's no concern of being led astray. As we believe, Chachma Begarb Tabib, that there's wisdom among the non-Jews as well. You know, the Torah, there's Torah only among Judaism. But we believe that there's wisdom and we have to embrace the world. We engage the world, we embrace it through the prism of Torah. So if there's a good idea and it makes sense and it's logical, so then it makes sense that we should follow this. That's the Rabbah.
Right,
the Vilna Gaon would say that he's sort of based on Sanhedrin. See, his argument is based on The Gemara in, he said, the Rabbi Yehuda in Maseches Sanhedrin says, it's only not Chukas Akum because it's written in the Torah. Otherwise, it would be Chukas Akum with the sword, even though there's a reason for it. So then he's sort of based on that. But let's see some contemporary examples, and then we'll see how it fleshes out.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah, sure.
Sorry, is there a distinction here between pagan and non-Jewish that's not pagan? Meaning we've seen that distinction made before in other chaburas? Is this, or are we like using pagan to broadly?
Oh, you say is it broad
non-Jews?
Yeah.
Here.
So the truth is, we're even going to see, which I didn't assign it or wasn't one of the sources, that there's even an opinion about heretical beliefs. Like, in other words, I'm going to spoil it. Like, the spoiler alert, okay? Like, in Oregon, in Shul, even during the week, in the 19th century, there were rabbis, you know, in traditional shuls who didn't want an organ in shul during the week. Again,
it's usually in a church.
They didn't say from the church, because that was associated with the Reform movement. When one of the initial reforms by the Reform movement was on Shabbos. It had a decently sound halachic argument. They said what? They said, we're going to have a non-Jew play music on Shabbos. So music itself, playing a musical instrument is a rabbinic prohibition. Right? You could tell a non-Jew to do that. But if a non-Jew does it, it's called the shvus, right? You know, imagine Alyssa just coming and just playing music. Well, she turns on the light for us, so she can play music, right? So he says, but makom mitzvah, it'll enhance the prayer service. So anyway, so they made that argument. And so in response to that, some rabbis broadened the definition to include even heretical beliefs. It doesn't deal with your question about non-Jewish, non-heretical. So let's
say the same thing about the English in the Orthodox Sidurim.
I was also going to ask about the sermon. We now give the sermon in English.
So then that was part of the debate between, let's say, the Chassam Sofer or Shimshon or Paul Hirsch, is just like, what do you associate with, you know, illicit reform behavior versus, you know, modernity that's not inconsistent with Torah values. That's
getting very gray for me.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
Well, that's the world we live in.
Yeah.
Because
when you were talking about the schism between Orthodox and Reform, it seemed like the sermon was like a sticking point then. Meaning the language of the sermon was given was
100%.
A sticking point.
So
that was not associated then with heretical beliefs later for us to adopt that.
Right, so first of all, there's a difference. There might be a difference between when that's adopted and then after it's established. In other words, it could be that initially when a certain practice is adopted, then it's associated with something that is, you know, that's associated with something that's heretical, but after, let's say, you know, like the first people to jump in, you say they're heroes, they're revolutionaries, but they could also be troublemakers. Uh-huh. So a lot of it depends on what it is associated with. I mean, that's right. At the end of the day, it's the same concept. If you believe that a certain belief system is antithetical to Torah values, then even if you do one practice that can sort of like, you know, it may not be the worst practice, you know, you can potentially justify it, but if that will sort of put you in that, well, if that eventually potentially leads you into that camp, and we have to be real about that, then, so that's the question. In other words, is the organ, the music, does that lead you into that camp? Does a sermon in German lead you into that camp? It's gray, but that's life, right? That's life. Life is not, life is complicated. Okay, so let's talk about some contemporary examples, okay? And we'll see how this fleshes out how the Vilna Gaon, how the Rama was, you know, how they were applied. So, in terms of theaters and stadiums, so again, it's very clear that these were places in the Rambam in Sefer Mitzvos, in Mitzvos Lota Se Lamed. This is on source 20, and also the Sefer Achinuch and Mitzvah Reish Samach Beis, source 22. So these were clearly places where they gathered for idol worship. So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva in source 23 in Yoredeya Chelek Dalid Siman Yud Aleph, Chelek Aleph, where Rav Moshe Feinstein basically, I mean, is he a fan of sports stadiums?
No, it's not Torah.
Right, it's with the Torah. It's, he said, but he says it's there's no prohibition. He does say, for our purposes, he does say there's no prohibition based on Chukas Akum, but he thinks it's frivolity and Bittul Torah. Now, again, many from Jews attend and watch sporting events. I would venture to say that many students who go to MTJ, you know, his yeshiva, do go to sporting event, went to sporting events. And again, the justification would be that, you know, watching them on occasion is no more or less Bittul Torah, or what he calls Moshav Leitzim, than other leisure activities that people participate in. So again, you know, if we justify, which, you know, if we justify leisure time, maybe he's upset that they're spending 3 hours at the game versus, I don't know, an hour, whatever it is. I'm saying I think this is probably actually more spiritually harmless than other activities. Yeah, I mean, you have stories of many gedolim as they're growing up. They were big Yankee fans. You know, you have these stories about these gedolim even when they're years later, when they heard like the Yankees won or something, they still felt it. You know, from their old days. So again, but the point is that, you know, Moshe is not so excited about this. But from a chukas, what's very clear from our purposes is that even though the Sifra mentions that theaters and stadiums were chukas akum, so it's clear that nowadays it doesn't seem to be that this is considered chukas akum. Now It's societal, okay? But it works in two directions. So fascinating debate. You know, the next source, the Minhag of Kaparos.
Can we go back to Rabbi?
Yes.
When you have a belief like that, that it's Bittul Torah,
right,
how do you account for the fact that some of the people he's saying it for are 11 years old versus some people are 40 years old?
Yeah.
Who should know better, let's say, not to participate in that. That's where this all... People are talking about it getting gray. It's gray because not everybody can function on the same.
Yeah, you know. Level. Again, I don't know specifically with respect to this tshuva. You know, this is something. I don't want to say for sure. I don't know. A lot of these things could be the information that he's being fed, not in a bad way. In other words, people might report. Like, what did he say here? It said it's an iser leitzanos, but the Torah v'gam od iser gadol yesh. The migrei yetzirhara arayas, but avshid the rumahem divrei nivol peh vasatel arayas. There's a lot of inappropriate language and temptations to arayas. You know, it's actually interesting. I mean, I'm not a holy person, but I have to say, I've never since I started working in shul, so my other job is either going to, you know, I'm driving to. You know, I was driving to this school or that school, the other school. So, like, when I get on the LIRR once in a while, I hear the language. Like, again, I'm not a holy person, but like, I'm just not used to it. And sometimes, I'm just saying, like, I'm just because I'm sheltered. I never thought I was so sheltered, but I guess I'm sheltered. Okay, I guess we all live in a little bubble here. You know, so I think that, you know, people were telling him that, you know, you can imagine people are telling him that, you know, that there's devil pag going on in the stadiums and like
drinking, not
after the seventh inning, I was like, okay, but they would tell him like probably all sorts of things that are going on and women not dressed properly. I'm just saying, like, so the question is that versus, you know, this is, I guess, for like a modern Orthodox family, this is perceived as actually as probably a more wholesome activity than some other potential activities, potentially, in terms of different things, that, right? So a lot of this would probably be in terms of one information that he was given, and, you know, like, I he wasn't giving a shiur on, like, let's see, all things you do in your leisure time, let's rate them one for the other. That's my thought in general, in terms of that. And, you know, to some extent, we're desensitized, so we do a lot of things. I mean, even things that might not technically be halakhically forbidden, but sometimes we do things that, you know, they're not necessarily we become desensitized to certain types of behavior. And so, you know, it's even though, let's say, we don't follow this, I always find, Moshe Feinstein in many instances, he's a very sensible person. He comes with many, he thinks about things in a very deep way. He's not always running to be strict, and he's, so it's good to hear sometimes when, like, you know, you read this and just to think about, you know, you know, when we're doing things to, we need leisure time, but how much leisure time do we need? Listen, we live in a crazy world. We have to, you know, we're dual income families and things are very crazy. We're very tired. Yishkoch to everyone coming out tonight, you know, to learn. It's hard for people to come out during the week, and I really applaud you all for coming. And it's hard for people to come out. But at the same time, you know, we want to try to, you know, as much as we can, spend time thinking about God, engaging in things, dealing with God, with Kadosh Baruch Hu, and trying to minimize our leisure time. So that's what this tshuva, you know, that's what it does for me, at least. Okay. On to the world of kaparos, with chickens, okay? It's an easier, okay, so for some it might be a very, controversial issue. So the earliest source for this custom of kaparos is found in the Gaonic era. There's a tshuva of Gaonim in the year 670 around Rav Sheshna Gaon. Basically, there's a tshuva where he mentions that someone take a chicken that was held by someone who placed his hand on the one receiving atonement and one hand on the chicken, and he would say, Zech tachazeh, this one is instead of this one, the sin's for here, it goes on him, or he'll be punished instead of, the chicken will be punished instead of him, and they see some psukim, and then the chicken is slaughtered. So why might that be problematic from a religious perspective? Yeah, it's what? Is that halakha? So why is that okay? It's like a sacrifice, you're saying?
Yeah.
Right. Sounds to me a little vicarious atonement a little here, you know? We don't believe in that, right? We don't believe in vicarious atonement for the most part, right?
All
right?
I was also thinking about
Tashlich. Right. So we throw away our sins. Yeah, so to say no. So that these practices are somewhat related. Again, if you just say it's tefillah, so some people like Dorachana would do Tashlich. If she would do it, so she would just say a tefillah, saying that I daven to Hashem, hopefully to strengthen myself, that I will, as a way for me to focus myself, that I should, you know, as a motivation for tshuva. If she would do that.
There's a Rabbi Chait commentary, I guess. We don't throw anything in the water.
I didn't say that. Yes. Yeah, okay, you got right. So I'm saying, so some look at it in terms of, like, are we actually throwing, no, but now, we no, so two things. Are you actually throwing something in the water? And
no,
symbolically,
it's not like we're giving the
sins away, but it's simply that you're diving to Hashem, that hopefully will help you throw away your sins. Or, you know, are you actually sort of mystically actually throwing away sins? Or are you sort of, you know, is it a way that you're thinking about tshuva? And it's, you know, sometimes there are behaviors that are triggers that get us to think about, you know, doing these things. So how do you view kapara? You know, how do you view kaparos in that regard, right? So the question is, does this violate Darchei HaMori? Is this also some kind of pagan practice? So the Ramban and the Rashba say it is. It's a pagan practice. So it's interesting. We think, I think, that we tend to think that Sephardim nowadays are more mystical and Ashkenaz are more, like, rational. Like, in terms of, I'm not saying, you know what I'm saying? Like, the Sephardim, they tend to more deal with mystics, and Ashkenazim are more like Litvaks. We're more like rational. In the days of the Rishonim, it was like the rabbis from the 11th to 15th century, it was often the reverse, that the Sephardim tend to be more rationalists. Okay? And this is a good example, where the Ramban and the Rashba, forget about. They said this is like a pagan practice. We shouldn't do it. But the Ashkenazic rabbis they said 100%. And in fact, the Shulchan Aruch rules, right? The Shulchan Aruch So Shulchan Aruch in Simon in Or Chaim Simon Tafreshe Seif Aleph. So he says, Shulchan Aruch says, we don't do this. See, the truth is, by the time the Shulchan Aruch, so Shulchan Aruch himself was a mystic. Shulchan Aruch lived in Tzfat, so he was a mystic. But he quotes all these Rishonim who were against this practice, you know. And the Ramah says, no, but we do it. We do this practice. And interestingly enough, Rav Yosef, you know, he's saying modern day Sephardim, he says it's not so bad to do this practice. It's okay. It's
Where does it come from?
So I'm saying the earliest custom is found in the Gaonim. So the earliest, the same thing, Tashlich, you know, it's also a later, it's a post-Gemara thing. It's a post-Gemara thing. See, this debate, someone argue, when they look at this debate, that someone argue that maybe this is the debate between the Ramah and the Vilna Gaon. Obviously, they're beforehand. But this could be a basis for a debate, which is what? This is a practical purpose. This is to help motivate you for, you know, tshuva, or can lead to atonement. But if it originates from idolaters, then it would be forbidden. Unless you would have thought of this on our own. Like to think of the chicken, That doesn't seem so. So some wanted to say that to do this practice, like a ritual practice, we wouldn't have thought of that on our own. So maybe the Vilna Gaon would say, his line of thinking might say it's not allowed, and if you're a Rama person saying that, you know, this has a practical purpose, maybe to motivate you for an achieve some kind of kapara, then even if it originated from something pagan, then it would be permitted.
Yeah. How would this relate to the Shlissel Challah?
I don't know what the origin of Shlissel Challah is. I can't comment on that.
I mean, it is something pagan.
Is it?
That's what.
Yeah. Okay. So if. Oh, yeah. It's okay.
So is that a similar thing?
Yeah, probably. Well, let's see. So say the Shlissel Challah.
You're saying, maybe it motivates. What's the?
I don't know. Yeah, but how does it?
Motivates you to. Is it motivates daven.
Yeah.
Shem for Parnassa.
Yeah. So maybe. But is there?
But if it's a pain.
Is there something Kabbalistic about it? That's what I'm saying. So I don't know. I don't know enough about.
Right.
I can't comment on that. But. I always,
it sounds very similar.
No, but I'll tell you why it might be different. I always thought that people look at this, again, I'm not familiar with it, but I always thought people look at it as a skula, and a skula sounds to be something maybe mystical. So there might be a counter pressure saying there's something pagan, but also there might be something mystical about it. So that might be I've never looked into it so much. I
mean, I think part of the problem is that in the Catholic countries,
right,
the eve of the new year, they bake a cake with a little mini JC inside of it.
Okay.
And whoever gets that slice benefits.
Okay, right.
So I'm sure that it's one of these.
Right. So I don't know if there's anything. I don't know if. I don't know. It could be. It could be.
Okay. How does this? How does where? What's the pagan source for this?
Right. So,
I'm still curious about.
No. I don't know the answer to that. But the Ramban at the end of source 24, in the Beis Yosef Or Chaim Tafer Shei Seifav, I didn't research this point, but he says this is maybe Mishum Darchei Amori. So it seems that he was aware. He believed that somehow, it might be very simply the idea of vicarious atonement that we get from the Christians, and it might
is
be
that on the list.
No, but again, if you hold.
No, I know.
No,
I know,
this
I
might
know.
Be the broader Darchei
Mori.
Yes, I don't know. You know, the broader Darchei Mori.
So this is interwoven, pagan tradition that's what we can call it,
right,
or some sort of non-Jewish tradition,
right,
woven into now Jewish ritual practice. How can we say so offhandedly that this is okay, but going to a stadium for a baseball game, we're going to really debate that?
Oh, first of all, they're not.
I know it's two different.
No, so first, so first of all, they're not saying this is necessarily okay. They're not saying this is okay. What I'm saying is this is a debate. The Ramah thought it was okay. The Ramah thought it was okay, and the Machaber, the Rabbi Yosef Karo, thought it was not. He thought it was not okay. He says Yesh Mashinogin Lasal Kapara Be'er Yom Kippurim Lishkol Tarnigol. He says, you should stop this custom. He thought this originates from a pagan practice. Again, and let me make this clear that the issue, let's say, that Ramosha Feinstein has about stadium and theaters has nothing to do with it being associated with a pagan practice. He's concerned with the here and now, what's going on in the stadium right now. In other words, when you're doing the Kaparos ritual, there's nothing licentious or that's where Moshe Feinstein's issue with that,
right.
and again with the stadium and theater issue is that back then it was an issue, so quite is an issue now. So he said it's not an issue now. Then it's simply a question of is it appropriate for a Ben Torah to go to things where there's nivel peg going on or there's inappropriate language. I'm saying hopefully during Kaparos there's no nivel peg going on, nothing inappropriate behavior like that kind of stuff.
No,
they do talk about, by the way, this was our topic, but one of the reasons why some were not happy with kaparos is because they would check the chickens very quickly and they would actually, it would be an inappropriate shechita and they would actually non-kosher chickens. So that was actually a practice, they would do a lot of them very quickly. So whatever the case is. But my point, it's a different,
I understand it's a different issue, yeah. It just seems...
No, so this is debated. But I'm saying...
That's why I'm shocked at that it's actually even debated.
What?
Because
Kaparos is debated?
Yeah.
No, I'm saying so it comes from... The point is, it originated from a pagan practice. It might be the vicarious atonement.
I'm saying, shouldn't it just not be okay?
Well, again, if now, again, so that's the debate. If you hold like the Ramban, the Maharik, that even if it originated from a pagan practice, if there is now, if it's similar, let's say, to a pagan practice, but now there is a good reason that it motivates people to do tshuva, so that it should be allowed. Okay, that's the argument. In other words, if let's whatever it was the. They talk. It's not our topic, but I know there's a. I know in Rambam Masifta, the kids don't wear caps and gowns for graduation, okay. But in other schools, they do. So that came from a pagan practice of caps and gowns. That's what the who wore that.
I think. Like,
or is it from a? Or is it because they don't know the origins?
No, whatever it was, and it came from it. But they say no, it's a sign of honor or whatever. So I'm saying, so like it's a lot of these questions. Like, what do you care about the origin or what's going or now, so that is the debate.
I think like the difficulty I'm having with it is that it's started to become interwoven into our traditional practice during like the most holy part of our year, and it stems from
right.
I think that's where.
Oh, you're saying how can we engage in this practice, right? How can we do something like that? Yeah.
I don't know. It's just,
yeah.
That's where I have
to. Okay, so you have to be like a follower of Cook. We're Mekadosh L'chol. We sanctify the mundane. We take things and we. No, so that's the question. No, it's a good question. Is it idolatry? If it comes from a custom, so can we quote unquote kosher it if in and of itself is not idolatrous? That is the question.
Right.
Maybe you're a Vilna Gaon person. Maybe you're a Vilna Gaon person. I don't know. Okay, so another example was walking without a head cover. Yeah.
Are we sure? I know it says. It's because of following the way of the Amorites, but are we sure that they actually did something like that?
So the Ramban. So again, I have to look it up. What he said. It might be this whole notion of vicarious atonement. Mm-hmm. There might be poly cases. I have to look in the 7th and 8th chapter. Tosefta. Is it actual Darchei Amori, or is it?
Possibly.
I'll look into it. Or is it something that is that concept, which is this kind of vicarious atonement, like they would get atonement through another object.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So another example was walking without a yarmulke. So again, what's interesting is that nowadays the people are, Rav Moshe Feinstein says that it's lenient if you have to do it for work. Okay, you have to. For my work, I have to wear a yarmulke. But some people for work, there could be leniencies not to wear a yarmulke. But the Taz, very interestingly enough, the Taz is that's in Or HaChaim, Simon Ches Seif Gimel. That's in source 29. So it's interesting. He thinks that maybe it's a violation of Chukas Akum if you don't wear a yarmulke. It's not simply like a pious thing to wear a yarmulke. You actually violate Chukas Akum. Why would you violate Chukas Akum for not wearing a yarmulke, you think?
Maybe like when they like, in a stadium,
right.
They sing the Star Spangled Banner,
right.
And their hats off. It's
right.
Like a sign of respect, like,
yeah.
I
think that's right, yeah. So I did a little bit of research on that. So I think that I've seen somewhere where they said, when you pass a church or when you go into a church, a hat is removed as a sign of respect. In the New Testament, there's in Corinthians, I think it's chapter 1, verse 11, I think. I have to check it out. I checked my commas. It says that men should remove their hats when they pray. I think women don't have to. I think men should remove their hats when they pray. So
women wear hats in church.
Right. The men don't, right. Right. So I think they take them with the hats. So this could be like an idolatrous practice to take off your hat when you go into the when you go somewhere. So it's not simply a pious Amidas Chasidus. But Moshe Feinstein said that's then. Maybe in the days Moshe Feinstein in Yerodea Chelak Dalet Seif Yud Aleph said, so that's maybe then. Back then there was this it may have been a pagan practice, but nowadays it's you take off your hat when you come inside. Some people take off their hat. Non-Jews, they go inside, they do it based on comfort, not based on some kind of religious ritual.
Maybe it's their understanding of da lifnei miata omed type of thing. That you're trying to show some honor to a god.
Right.
They don't have a lot of requirements in their
right.
day and day out
right.
life, and this is the one thing that they can do when
they're right. when you go in there. Yeah, yeah. So,
I mean, it's interesting because we, never would take, like, that's the one place we would never take, or men would never take their yarmulke off. You know what I mean? Like shul, no one's doing it in shul. So like to me, if you go to a restaurant and take your yarmulke off, like why is that equal to removing your hat in church? Like we would never remove a head covering as part of our service.
Right. So is it similar to that? Well, again, is it similar to what they do? Well, let's think about this. If you're wearing your yarmulke, let's say people wore hats. Back then, everyone wore hats, mm-hmm. and they just took it off after. So by us taking it off, we are mimicking their practice.
But
that's what they're doing. That's their practice. Forget what we do. The point is, that's what they do in church.
Anybody who wears a hat takes it off.
No,
a hat all the time.
No, but back then, in the days of the Taz, they only took it off for religious reasons. That's what most. See, now they take it off for comfort.
But my point is, we would never. That's the one place that we would never remove our hat. Meaning, no one's going to go to shul and remove their hat there, right? To daven.
You're saying because
like, you're taking a yarmulke off to daven. It's like you're going.
You're saying because we don't do what we worship, so it's the we don't take it off, so we're not mimicking them because we do different. We have our religious practice.
I'm just saying, why would taking your hat off like somewhere random be mimicking their religious practice if our religious practice has us keeping hats on anyway?
No, but that's the whole point. So then, if we're taking it off, then we're mimicking their practice.
No, but.
You don't have to be
when we go indoors, if it's a sign of respect to God or whatever, take off your hat. So when we're doing that, we're actually saying I'm not identifying as a Jew, I'm identifying as a Christian.
So you're saying every time that these people would take off their hats back in the day, it was it came from that.
That's what Moshe Feinstein, that's what he says. He says that that it used to be they would do that, and perhaps as a sign of respect whenever they go in. So Moshe said that nowadays people remove their hats as a sign of comfort, not as some statute. Okay, so this I found interesting, the discussion about standing for the siren in Israel on Yom HaShoah and Yom HaZikaron. I found that as very interesting because the reasons why it's hard for someone to say it's forbidden, obviously. If you have a situation, in other words, you could simply say, if it's a lack of respect to the secular Israelis to say, for my religious reasons, I can't stand up. The question is, what reason are we going to use? In other words, you can see that post-game, rabbis are going to try really hard to find a way why we shouldn't stand out, and because it obviously would be perceived as a blatant sign of disrespect if secular Israelis mm-hmm. are standing up for people who died in the Holocaust and for people who died on Yom HaZikaron, and Orthodox Jews don't stand up. That would be perceived as a sign of disrespect. So the question is the reason why we do that, I'm just asking, should we we could say, okay, we should stand up as a sign of respect. Should you say, because if we're among secular Jews, then we should stand up. But if you can, maybe try to be in a private area so you don't have to stand up. Should we say that maybe you should learn while you're standing up, because standing up is a pagan practice? I'm just saying there are different ways to solve this problem. Assuming you believe that standing up for the dead is a pagan practice, it could be that how do we respect the dead, we say Kaddish. Is a moment of silence, is that a pagan practice, is that a Jewish practice? Okay? So, in other words, the only reason why we're saying that we should stand up is that because, it's going to look bad for us. So it's interesting to see how different rabbis, dealt with this. So for example, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook in Tchumim is a journal of halachic articles. So in the third volume of Tchumim, so he says that, very simply, we follow that, he's following the Ramah. He's saying that clearly, even though that this originated from a pagan practice, he's saying that what? He's saying that you only violate b'chugoseh lo teilechu if it's, let's say, there's no reason, there's nonsense, it's associated with idol worship. Here, you're doing this out of respect. So obviously you should stand. But again, if he would hold like the Vilna Gaon, then it's not so clear that You'd have to find a different reason. I mean, it would look bad. Again, we want to get to a place where we don't seem disrespectful. The question is, how do you get there? So Tzvi Yehuda Cohen Cook says that we follow the Ramah, that even though it may have originated from a pagan practice, nevertheless, since this is a good reason, it's a sign of respect, so therefore, we can stand. Rav Ad Yosef is like, he's a little ambivalent, right? Rav Ad Yosef, in Yaakov Yosef, Kitta Shulchan Aruch, Yordea Kufayim Ches, Seif Ches, he says that he actually says, if it depends. He said, if you're walking in a place where if you don't stand, it's going to cause a chil Hashem, right? Then you should stand up. But if not, maybe not. Maybe you should say a chapter of Tehillim. Again, we're not saying that you shouldn't show respect for people dying in the Shoah, or you shouldn't show respect for people dying Yom HaZikaron. But maybe the right thing to do, okay, is to maybe at 10 o'clock, whatever the time is, sit down, take a parak of Tehillim, and start reading that parak of Tehillim. Maybe that's a more authentic Jewish way to remember the deceased, by saying a few parakim of Tehillim. Again, because of Chil Hashem, we want to avoid that. But what Rav Yosef is saying is that maybe if you're in private, maybe that's the way to do it. That's an authentic Jewish way. Again, you're not disrespecting them, but the way that an authentic Jewish response to respecting the dead is to maybe sit down and say parakim of Tehillim.
Like during that moment of silence, it's making me a better person because I'm thinking about how I can be a better Jew because of all of these things. It's sort of like, you know,
right, but
can it just be as simple?
No, so 100%. But no, but Chana, that.
It seems
no, but okay. That no. But
it bothers me that things are just so logical,
right?
Like that should just be decent. Human decency,
right?
And like, right. Has to be debated in such a manner,
right?
That makes it into some.
It depends. Highly
inappropriate. We're doing kapara, where it's like potentially really a pagan ritual.
Right.
I don't know why this is making me so upset, but
right.
We have to debate up the wazoo about whether or not
right. So again. It's a question of how you understand the prohibition of b'chukos lo teilecho. That's really the question. In other words, should we? Anything that stems from a pagan practice, but you're in good company of following the Ramah. All I'm saying is the Gra has a different view on this. So I'm saying it's a debate in how you learn the Gemaras. I mean, they weren't dealing with this modern day contemporary issue. They were dealing with they're analyzing the Gemaras and they're saying that this is that they feel that the Torah feels that anything that has an origin to a pagan practice. So are you looking for a logic behind it, or are you looking for this is a ritual law that this looks too much like something pagan because it comes from something pagan, so we should stay away from it. That's really, yeah.
Is there any difference in standing for sirens in Israel than say for 9/11 victims?
No, it's the same thing. Same thing. 100% same thing. Right. Same thing. Right. Same thing. Right. So Rav Melamed says, I mean, so he's again hedging. He's saying that in Rav Melamed wants to argue that you should think about. He said, if you're thinking about those who died, so this is called thinking about words of Torah. And he says, furthermore, you shouldn't separate yourself from the community. By the way, let me make this clear. It's not like when you're debating it, what happens is, if you have a framework, right, you have rules, right, and you've sort of established, these are the parameters for what's allowed, what's not allowed, and then you have something that doesn't seem right, right? Like, in other words, we have these rules, and like it seems like these rules seem to make sense. And then later on, you have this contemporary situation. This doesn't smell right. This doesn't sound like it makes sense. So the question is, how we deal with it? Do we sort of redefine our parameters? Or do we say that, you know, it's a question, or do we say, you know, this doesn't apply for this reason? So we have the gross parameters. That anything that has origins from something pagan, unless you would have come to it on our own, so he would say that, you know, standing, you know, that's something that you wouldn't come to on your own. Okay? So therefore, he would say that you have to find some other reason to allow it. Again, they're not only debating, other than Rabbi Yosef, they're not debating, you know, should you do it, they're debating why. How does it fit into our initial framework of understanding halacha, right? Halacha is, right. Here are the rules, and here are contemporary situations, so how do contemporary situations fit into those rules, right?
So it seems like, according to a lot of these posts, really, lechatchila, there should never have been
a siren instituted into the framework of the Yomazikaron Yomashoah. Like, this is all kind of a bidya, but once the siren exists, this is how we should.
Well, again, if you hold like the Ramah, then I don't think you have a problem at all. Because if you think it's logical, it's reasonable, then you could debate. You could debate what is more. Notice, you could debate what's better. Is it better to recite a chapter of Tehillim, or is it better to stand in silence? That's something different. 100%. No. And that's part of the debate. In other words, and that's a fair part of the equation. In other words, is it better? And listen, we have this debate a lot ourselves. In other words, do we sometimes compromise our let's say the traditional way of doing something should be one way, but by doing something a little less traditional, we can get the broader community to participate, so that it may be worth it for something more, much more powerful. I mean, Yom HaShoah is an example of that, where the Mizrahi party wanted Yom HaShoah to take place on Asara B'Teves, the 10th day of Teves. They felt that was the appropriate day to commemorate Yom HaShoah, or those who felt that it should be on Tisha B'Av. But there was a compromise. There was a compromise with the secular people as part of the committee, in order to try to get everyone in Israel to commemorate Yom HaShoah instead of just the Orthodox. So 100%. So that's sort of you're trying to sort of balance those factors. But my point is, we still have to just understand what the, you know, what the issues are and how it fits into that.
You know, I was going to actually ask if you know that if this particular debate started was started before it instituted in the State of Israel, when they started doing that. They do moments of silence outside of Israel, so
right.
Did this become like a debate after it started in Israel, or was it before?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know when they. Well, I'm trying to think when they had. But I could imagine that, you know, the notion of standing for a moment of silence is like a Christian, is like, you know, that's like a, like for, I don't know, you see this a lot, right? When, like, you know, in regular non-Jewish funerals, people have moments of silence. That's so that you could see that might be associated with a non-Jewish, you know, that could be Doron Chanan, it could be your question about, is it non-Jewish or Christian ritual? It could be related to that. You know, as opposed to we have a way to do things ourselves. But what's interesting is this of Yaakov Ariel in one of his tshuvos says, we would have come to this on our own. So he said that the moment of silence, no, he said this is logical, this is reasonable. So you know, when you asked me initially, I don't know. Kaparos, I don't think we would have come to our own. You know, that I wouldn't think we would come to our own. But it's interesting to see how different Rabbonim come to allow this. So one says, you say, Ravad Yosef, he is considered for the Gra, I think. He's considered for the Vilna Gaon. And he says, but when there's Chil Hashem, obviously you have to stand. But if you can avoid it, avoid it. But others will say, we follow the Ramah. Or when you stand up, you're thinking about Torah, so it's certainly appropriate. Or he's saying, we would have come to it on our own. So even according to Vilna Gaon, it's not a problem. So there's a disparity of opinions when it comes to that. Okay? So then we talk about Avelus. Okay, we talk about customs of Avelus. So the idea of wearing black or flowers, okay, is that a violation of Chukas Akum? So again, is that logical or not? You know, is it, so I guess, I think this is an example where this is the origin. It's interesting here because the origins, I think, are like, I think are something pagan, but there seems to be reasons for it. You know, black is a sign of, you know, mourning, and flowers is to make the grave look nice. Like, that doesn't seem to be, there seems to be logical reasons for it. There is a Minchas Elazar, and it's not in your source, it's not in the sources, in Chelak Dal Siman Samach Aleph, who gives four reasons why he's against having flowers, you know, on Jewish graves. And yeah, they're okay, the reasons. I'm not sure how compelling they are, in my opinion. Some of them are more compelling. But he says that, you know, one of them is that Chazal or sages taught that the rich and the poor must be buried alike. So there's something to this. Is placing flowers on the graves of the wealthy divides the classes. So the truth, there is something to that. That's why people are buried in a pine, you know, everyone has the same casket. Right, they don't. We don't.
What about headstones?
Right, so headstones. They haven't done that. Right, they, that didn't. That's right. So, You're right. I don't know. Like,
well, in certain cemeteries, the plot costs more than.
Yeah. No, I understand. Right. So the question where we apply that and where we don't apply that. Yeah. It could, again, this is in his community, and I don't know if he had rules about headstones in his community. It's interesting. There are some, you know, people who died and they only want something very simple. They didn't. They told people don't have an elaborate headstone. But
right. I was watching a newscast.
Yeah.
Where I don't remember the circumstances, but the person who was being buried was Jewish, and the commentator said, "It's so sad. They obviously couldn't even afford flowers."
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No. So there's something. There's something. Okay. Right. Question. Right. So the also. So, there, he also says that placing edible items into a casket is forbidden according to halacha, as it is a waste of God's bounty. He says putting good fragrant flowers, which could possibly be used as spices in a place where they may not be used, is the same issue. He says also you can't benefit from a casket or anything associated with the dead, even the earth which covers them. Therefore enjoying the fragrance of flowers placed on graves would be forbidden. And planting flowers there in the first place is just inviting trouble. And the fourth, he says, is b'chukosem lo telechu. Is this. So again, the truth is, I think...
Flowers, but a lot of people have...
So shrubbery people use, right. So the truth is that we've... Right, it's hard to know exactly... Yeah, it's hard to know, you know, where this fits in and what would be allowed. Like, so, there are certain things that may not technically violate Chukas Akum, but there's just such a strong Jewish tradition that this is what we do. I think this is an example, because I think I'm not sure. Like if you hold like the Ramah, you know, to say that it's forbidden, I guess, you know, maybe something edible, I don't know. So like, but he's very strong. Sometimes you have these Jewish customs that are just very, very strong, very powerful, and this is the way we bury our dead. And but like I mentioned, some Jewish to deal with this, Jewish cemeteries do have shrubbery. Mm-hmm. There was an issue I think what the Young Israel has. I think I asked, and first I heard, I was not familiar. This is years ago that someone asked me about this. And I spoke to one person, and he said, yeah, it's Chukas Akum, we don't do it. And someone said, no, but a lot of cemeteries, they do have, it's custom to have Jewish
perpetual
shrubbery. You pay money for it. Okay, so there's this tension, I guess, you know, between some of these customs, you know, to try to maintain. So this comes out, you know, also, you know, I don't, I'm sorry? Different Chadisha have different views in terms of that. I won't, you know, when... I don't know, rightly or wrongly, I guess. You know, I'll do kriya on someone if they have, you know, I'll do regular kriya. I won't rip when they have a ribbon. I'll let someone else do it. I don't know. I feel like I'm not...
It's not the real thing.
It's not the real thing, so I won't do it. No, so but they take a black ribbon and they rip it. I'll have someone else do it. I just... They call me. They take a black ribbon. Yes. No, so I just said, to my knowledge, because I don't know what people say behind my back. No, I understand, but some people. No, I'm saying, but that's a. I'm saying to my knowledge. I don't know if people say by my back. My knowledge. I say this not. I just do, you know, the Orthodox. You know, I do the Orthodox thing.
They don't want to waste a shirt.
So whatever. It's not. Yeah. So that's not. That yeah. So I feel like, you know, I don't know. I felt like it's a strong, you know, Jewish, you know, ritual that so I don't do the ribbon. I'm not judging people do it, but I just don't. Okay. Thanksgiving.
Sorry.
So again, Thanksgiving. Right. So that. At the very least, started with Christians. Thanksgiving started with Puritans that were closely aligned to Avodah Zarah. Okay? You have Rav Huttner is opposed to it, Rav Menashe Klein is opposed to it. Moshe Feinstein is like, he hedges his bets. You know, not hedges his bets, I'm sorry. Moshe Feinstein is very, he has a whole bunch of tshuvas. I think you read one of them. But Moshe Feinstein, like, he seems to say the more ritualistic it is, the more problematic it is. He's like, he's a little uncomfortable. I think he feels like, again, I don't think it's the strict letter of the law, according to Moshe Feinstein. I think he says the more that you make it like fixed rituals, the more you might be adding a holiday. If you feel you have to have it, you have to have turkey. So he's like uncomfortable with it. Rabbi Soloveitchik thought it was permitted. Rabbi Soloveitchik, you know, had, quotes a Nefesh HaRav, right, in source 41, that you can eat turkey on Thanksgiving. You know, he said, Mutter Lecho, Basar Hodu, Besof November, Beyom Thanksgiving. Right? You could have turkey on Thanksgiving, although they tell the famous story where Salvation he gave shear on Thanksgiving. Right? Depending on what shear you have in YU, most of the shear in YU are off for Thanksgiving. Or let's put it this way. YU is off for Thanksgiving. But my son was in Rav Shechter's shear last year. He had shear on Thanksgiving. He's in Rav Ronsweig's shear this year. I'm not sure. I don't think I had shear in Thanksgiving. Rav Ronsweig was giving shear. But okay. Rav Salvechik did give shear on Thanksgiving. And the story goes that he was flying back to Boston. And the shamish was trying to nudge him. His assistant, we got to go. You missed the flight. At some point, he's like, we're not leaving until we get this tosis right. Because he was still going over the tosis. Obviously, he appreciated eating a turkey, but he wanted to make sure he understood tosis. That's important also. Mm-hmm. Tosis is also important, even on Thanksgiving. But Thanksgiving might be different also because it was nationalized. Originally, it was a Christian holiday. But then once it was nationalized, it became an Americanized. So then maybe, even though he had a Puritan origin and it was Christian nature, so maybe it's different now. But this, again, might relate to this debate between the Rama and the Gra, in terms of how you view Thanksgiving. As I mentioned to you, two other examples, the Mishnah and Chulin, Daf Bem Alpha and Bay states that you're not allowed to slaughter animals over a hole in the ground. Or it might be a mound in the ground. I think it made a hole in the ground because the heretics would slaughter animals over holes in the ground. It wasn't a pagan practice, it was a heretical practice. So the Malamed Lahoil, Rado Tzvi Hoffman, and the Sri De'esh, that's Rechir Yaakov Weinberg, he was a big posek in Germany, head of the Hildesheimer Seminary, before the Holocaust, and he ended up living in Switzerland. He was probably the modern Orthodox posek in the 20th century. Both of them before, in the first half of the 20th century. So they're both of the opinion that a custom that was initiated by heretics and viewed as a sign or a symbol associated with their belief is strictly prohibited. So therefore, they believed, and all the German rabbinic scholars of the 19th, 20th centuries rejected the idea of using organs in the synagogue, even on weekdays, as its use in shul was initiated by the Reformed community of the time, and it became the symbol of the movement. So when you ask about speaking the vernacular, it's a perception question. What becomes the symbol of the movement? You can have two modern rituals, mm-hmm. and... this is associated with reform. This is associated with this anti-traditional movement. It's hard to know. It just depends what is, and you can have different people debating. I don't know if this is accurate or not, but there's this modern debate going on whether you can have music playing in shul, for slichos, a guitar in slichos, or for Rosh Chodesh. And I wonder whether this is this debate, nowadays, I don't think it's a concern that, someone's going to become reform if they're playing the guitar for Rosh Chodesh. My first experience with that, I was at a JNF, a Jewish National Fund mission, with different Orthodox rabbis. So I think I think those who are a little more into Chovaveh, more open Orthodox. So this practice, I'm not saying this is they're much more spiritual when it comes to these things. We're davening, and all of a sudden I'm doing tachlin. I get up for tachlin, and I see someone doing guitar, singing Shomer Yisrael after tachlin. Whatever, women don't do tachlin, right? So you know the Shomer Yisrael. Okay, whatever. So but anyway, right after Shmon Esrei. We're saying with Tachnun, and then all of a sudden someone's playing guitar. It's not necessarily. I'm not saying that's not orthodox. I hadn't heard it before, but that's. I mean, Rabbi Avi Weiss at Chasna's, he's known to they have a whole thing going on there. They play the bongos and the guitar, whatever. They do a whole thing, so they're very musical. So this is the first time that I experienced this. But then I heard YU. I think Rabbi Kenny Brandon, he was at YU. I think they had. Rosh Chodesh, one Rosh Chodesh meeting where they did play musical instruments, and sometimes in Slichos they play. So I wonder if this runs into this question as well. And the final thing is, in your booklet, it's in Hebrew, but there's an article, there's a tshuva, it's actually on page 1:26 that was posed to Eretz Chamda, which is the religious Zionist Kollel. It's in Hebrew, and it's a question about yoga. He said it's yoga because yoga, it comes from a Far Eastern religion. So again, they're lenient. Why? They say we follow the Ramah, we don't follow the Vilna Gaon. And then they say maybe even if you follow the Vilna Gaon, it might be okay. I think because they're saying you might have come to it on your own. You might realize, like, I think like, you know, where you draw the line, I think it's not so, I'm not so, no, this, no, mindfulness. I'm saying the idea of mindfulness, in today's world of mindfulness, so you might come to it on your own. But in practice, they're lenient. However, if they say, like, he writes that if like in some of these people who do yoga, they do some of the, if they do some kind of like pagan chants, so then they're not sure about that. Okay, you're mentioning some pagan chants, so then it might be problematic. But yoga itself, so this is Ramah said is permitted, but this is interesting. So I think that this all goes down to this question of the Ramah and the Gra. Again, it seems that most posts can hold like the Ramah, so as long as there's a reason, then it seems that. It seems that many posts can say that a lot of these issues, that these different practices would be permitted. Okay?